I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. Indulge me in a moment of silence and I'll open with a prayer. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in other people, and a much-needed new experience with this program of recovery. Amen. God, you know, I could go on about the amends thing. There's just so much to talk about, but it's such an important thing. But we're running out of time. And so I want to move on to step 10 and 11 and 12, but the steps that have seemed to sustain me last all these decades. Page 84 starts the section on step 10. And this is right after the results of step 9, which is often referred to as the ninth step promises, which, you know, it's odd to me that we, and I kind of understand it, the fellowship worldwide has adopted the ninth step promises as the promises, when in actuality there's promises after every action step. And the promises to me in step 10 are really what I come here for. I know why we tout the ninth step promises, because they could fit on a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. I mean, you know, a new freedom and a new happiness, you know, it's all very flowery, very cool. But if I don't get the 10th step promises, I'm going to probably, with a new freedom and a new happiness, drink myself to death. Because it's the only the 10th step promises that saved me. But we're going to work into that. In the middle of the 84, it says, this is coming out of the ninth step promises. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue. Now, it's going to use this word continue over and over and over again on this page and then the next page. We continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We have vigorously commenced this way of living as we've cleaned up the past. We've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch. Almost as if they're really trying to make a point here. And I think unconsciously when I was new after I did my fifth step and had made some amends, and I think I unconsciously thought that step 10 said, continued to take personal inventory, and if you were ever, but I know it's not going to happen, but if I ever was wrong, that I'd promptly admit it, but it's not going to happen. And what it says, doesn't say, it says when wrong, which implies that buckle in, you're going to be wrong a lot. And yet how I delude myself at times, no problem here. And yet I've been selfish, I've been dishonest, I've been resentful. I mean, I'm not just resentful for no reason. People I resent sort of deserve it. But I'm resentful just the same. And so I have to continue to watch for this. For what? For the manifestations of self. That really has always been the root of my problems. When it talks in chapter 5, I really get this. It has pained me over the years that selfishness and self-centeredness really and truly is the root of all my problems. And its manifestations, self squirming for the spotlight, squirming for more material stuff, squirming for more attention, squirming for more prestige, notoriety. It just always is doing that. So I have to continue to watch for this stuff. And I love this line. It says, we've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And for some of us, the first just soiree into any kind of other-centeredness or understanding of anyone and being ultimately effective started in a combination of this fourth step when we started to look at these things from an entirely different angle. And I start to understand the people that I resented. I start to put myself in their place, and I get it. I see it now. Now I'm looking at it from their point of view. Okay, I get it. And it's for me, it was the beginning of the first time I ever got unself-centered enough to even start to understand someone else, to look past myself, to get you. And consequently, through step 9, became very effective with some people, and in step 12, become very effective. And it says that we have entered the world of the Spirit. What's that? I noticed something all my life. I didn't understand it. I resented it at times. But there seemed to be people growing up in the neighborhood, in school, and in different jobs and places I went, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. These people that life just works for. These people that everything they touch turns to gold. Everybody loves them. Everything works for them. It's just amazing. And then there's me who's battling, breaking my back here, and and they just easily come to them what I am fighting and struggling to get and cannot get. And I thought, and some of the people that had it all, that just everything they turned to gold. Everybody loved them. Everything worked well for them. Their relationships are great. Their business, everything's great for them. I'm smarter than them. And my life's crap. And they got all that. It seemed very unfair to me. And I think what it was is that they were not born with an exaggerated sense of themselves as I was. In the third step, it says something interesting. It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Now, when I was newly sober, my sponsor used to nail me with that. I would come to him with these, you know, I'd save up like all these little petty resentments that I don't even think are resentments because I'm right. And I would come to him and I'd start laying them on him. Like, you know, the guy in the AA meetings that's selling Amway in the parking lot after the meeting. That ain't right. The guy who drank four cups, I counted them, four cups of coffee and didn't put any money in the basket. The 13 steppers, oh my, I got on this tirade about 13 steppers. My sponsor said, you're just jealous they're getting more action than you are, that's all. Hey, don't confuse me with the truth. You know, bad people at work that weren't doing half of it, and they were getting notoriety and the boss patting them on the back, and I'm doing the hard work here. And I dump this all on him, and he'd always say the same thing. You've got to quit playing God. I think, I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. I'm not. And I didn't see that I climbed up onto some throne of judgment. And I was judge, jury, and executioner in my mind. And the problem is I was the guy that was alone in that state of separation from them through my judgment, through playing God. And some people never do that. They hardly, you know, one of the things that, when it says in chapter 3 that we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, you know, it's the bodily different thing is an apparency. I mean, we pick up a drink, it sets something in motion. We can't get back in the cage. But I am also mentally different. But the great promise of Alcoholics Anonymous is when the spiritual malady is overcome, I will straighten out mentally and physically. So, contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I'm not nuts anymore. But I could be. I could be easily left unchecked. For me just to sink into me and make me the center of the universe, again, I get very weird quick. I am not cured of alcoholism. Very quick. And what seems to happen in alcohol, what I believe these people that everything worked for, They were just in the zone of God's world. But the alcoholics are not one with God's world. We're like, imagine all the alcoholics in the world are ants on this giant tree trunk going down a river, and every single ant is imagining he's steering, right? Come on, guys, lean this way. You know, I mean, we all think we're doing something here. And normal people aren't trying to run the universe. No, it's not that they don't have a way occasionally and they get disappointed. But the book says that something interesting. It says that we are extreme examples of self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. So, matter of fact, if you're sitting here going, I'm not an extreme example, you just qualified for it. And yet, I don't think so. But I am. My daughter, and I love to use her as an example, she's one of the most spiritually, emotionally, and mentally focused, right-on, balanced people I've ever met. I don't know how. She's my daughter. I don't know how that happened. I'm telling you, I have no idea. It's just God's mercy. My big fear when she was growing up is she'd end up like I was, and it would have broke my heart. She's a very well-balanced person. She does not react to life the way I react to life. She is not an extreme example. That doesn't mean that she doesn't get sad. It doesn't mean that she doesn't get angry and her feelings hurt from time to time. She's just not an extreme example of it, as I will tend to be. A while back, she ended a relationship. And I'm her dad. We're very close. And I got together with her, and she was telling me about it. And I said, oh, Kate, I'm so sorry. And I'm trying to say daddy things to her, like, you know, well, you got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your prince or something. I'm trying to say daddy stuff, you know. I don't know what daddies say, but I'm trying to be that guy. I love my daughter. I love her. I'm trying to comfort her. And she's got a pretty good attitude. Well, I get together with her almost a week later, and we're having dinner, and I said, so Kate, how's it going? She said, it's going good, Dad. I said, no, I mean, with the relationship breakout. Oh, she said, Dad. I said, you know, it's you can't just got to move on with this stuff. I'm going to go out on a date this next week and with somebody, and she said, you know, you can't hang on to that stuff. I said, move on? Oh, Kate, you couldn't have possibly got enough mileage out of that just yet. I mean, I would have been taking that to meetings. I'd have been writing about it. I've been calling. I'd be ruining my sponsor would have cauliflower ear from me calling him on the phone. I mean, but see, she's not prepared to drink of that emotional track as I drink of it alcoholically. She's not an extreme example. She just goes on with her life. She doesn't want to. She doesn't have this need to stare at what's wrong. Maybe as if she's Superman with laser vision is going to dissolve it if I stare at it long enough. She just goes on. And my daughter lives in the zone. There was a famous basketball game in the U.S. years ago. It made sort of part of a big piece of basketball history now. And it was when Michael Jordan was at his peak. Now, some of you guys might not know who he was. He was one of the best basketball players in the U.S., probably one of the top of all times. And there was a game, and it's right down to like the last minute of the game or so, or even less, like seconds. And they're tied. And Jordan, at about three or four seconds before the buzzer, before the end of the game of a tie game where they're going to have to go into over, I don't, whatever, I'm not sure what was going to happen, but he takes a desperate almost half-court shot at the basket, and it swishes in. And the crowd went berserk. They're on their feet screaming and cheering and going nuts. And there's a famous scene of Jordan kind of lightly jogging down the court, looking at all these people screaming and cheering and yelling his name. And he just went like this. He just shrugged his shoulders. And later they said, what was that about? And he said, well, I don't know how I did that. And he said, well, how'd you do it? And he said something that was classic. He said, well, he said, sometimes you just get in the zone. And when you're in the zone, you can't miss. And I think the realm of the spirit's the zone. Where you're not trying to run the universe, you're going with the flow. You're awake enough to see how your actions are affecting other people. You're other-centered enough to be one with and useful. And the thing about being of service and being useful at life, there's a cause and effect here. The world and the life itself and the universe will return to you good stuff in almost direct proportion to how much you're, how helpful you are to people. It's the universe is a funny place. If you attack it and try to control it, it resists and pushes back. But if you try to serve it and help God's kids, it will push the love back at you too. It's almost in life, there's this funny thing that self-serving alcoholics of my type who want to play God never get. They're not awake to the reality of you will get what you give. Alcoholics Anonymous introduced me to that when I was early. I remember I'm going to meetings and I don't feel like I fit. You know how that feeling, like it seems like everybody in this AA group knows everybody and then there's me. You know what I mean? I'm the odd guy. I'm the guy that doesn't belong. I'm the guy that doesn't feel right here. And this old timer grabbed me and he said, I got a job for you. And I was just delighted. He's even talking to me. I'm just anybody talking to me. I was just delighted. He said, I need you to do something. It's very important. I said, well, yeah, what? He said, I want you to watch for the people that are brand new. And he said, I want when you see somebody that you know is new as you are or around the same time or less, I want you to go over to them and try to make them feel welcome. And he said, the reason we want you to do this is that it's fresh with you. You know what it feels like to get sober. You just did. You know how uncomfortable it feels to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and feel like it's all of them and there's only you. And you will be the guy who can really let this new person know that there legitimately is someone here that knows how they feel. And you can try to make them feel welcome. And I started doing that. And I, honest to God, I have no idea if I ever made anybody feel more welcome in AA except me. I felt well. I started feeling like this is my home here because I'm getting what I'm trying to give. And you get what you give in life. And that's why it's so important to claim the primary purpose of helping other alcoholics in this altruistic movement. Because if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you stay locked into the taker's position and you remain a taker, there's nothing to get here. I mean, all we got's alcoholism. That's all you're going to get is alcoholism because that's what we got. You're here, we can have mine. I don't want it. I mean, if you're a taker, you're going to get alcohol. But if you become a giver, the givers get it all here. Look around your home, the groups you know, and look at the people that laugh a lot and smile a lot. And if they're chronic alcoholics as you are, chances are they're sponsoring people and they're doing service and they're helping people and they're showing up early and helping with it. They're giving in to the process and consequently they're getting from it. So I think that that's the realm of the spirit. It's a realm that's often free from me. It's a realm that where I've made the transition. Maybe not permanently. Maybe I'll regress back as we often do, but I've moved away from a life driven by fear to a life motivated more by love and service. I've moved away from a life of self-reliance to a life of God-reliance. I've moved away from a life of self-centered to now I'm becoming other-centered, and it's beautiful. So we continue. It says, this is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When, not if, when these crop up, here's what we do. Four things. First, ask God at once to remove them. Two, discuss them with someone immediately. 3, make amends quickly, which in some cases is 3 months. I know how I am. I'm the kind of guy that will drive with a flat tire. I hope it goes away. You know what I mean? And I've done that. And I'll tell you something. When they say quickly, make it quickly. The longer you sit, the only person that suffers from your unmade amends is you. Quickly. Because I know I've resisted it. I put it off. And it's like a stone in your shoe. It doesn't go away. You're the one that pays the price, right? Quickly, if we've harmed anyone, then this is the new default position. My default position coming in here was me, and now the new default position. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. It says that over and over again in this book. Ask God to do this, blah blah blah, and turn our thoughts to someone else, blah blah blah, blah, and see who we can help. Ask God in our morning meditation how we can do for the man who's to. It's like a theme through this altruistic program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess that's why they call it our primary number one purpose. Above everything, above ourselves, is to help others, to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I had a nun in school that I never liked her much, but She was actually pretty spiritual, which is probably why I didn't like her. And she used to say, God first, you second, me last. That seemed awful to me. And I think she's right. I think she's right. Love and tolerance of others is our code. If you're ever in a AA trivial contest, that's, I'll ask you what's the code of Alcoholics Anonymous? Love and tolerance of others. Bill Wilson, one time in a letter, said that he believed that honesty brought us to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was only tolerance that would keep us here. And I must constant, in order to survive this giant dysfunctional family of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, look objectively what we are here. This is the world's largest outpatient clinic. I mean, you know, if you start coming here expecting people to be normal, you're gonna get your heart broke here. I'm telling you, this is what it is. And I'm on a bad day. I'm one of the nuts here. None of us ever rise above our disease. Permanently. We may, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, seem to rise above it intermittently. And so I have to constantly change my perception of you to allow you to be who you are so that I can be here without the friction. In mechanics, they often talk in engines and they often talk about tolerances. Sometimes in an engine, because of a buildup of kinetic energy, it builds up so long over a period of time that the energy, the heat, will actually start to warp the parts of the engine very slightly. And what happens is the tolerances get off. And when the tolerances get off, what starts to occur is now the moving parts are not moving freely of each other. They're starting to create friction. And if they create enough friction long enough, what happens? The engine blows up. So what happens when you get an engine that the tolerance is off a lot, you have to disassemble the engine, and in a machine shop, sort of like what we do in step 4, or in maybe the concentrated version of step 10, is you have to change the tolerances so that the parts can move freely of each other without causing so much friction that there's a blow up. And that's what I have to do with you. I have to change my expectations, my perception of you, to allow you to, just like me, to be who you are. Because on a bad day, isn't it funny? When I'm out of line, I'm having a bad day, and I'm just acting badly or childishly, I want everybody in the world to understand. But am I willing to do that for you? And That's the important thing. It's not, it's like it says in the prayer of St. Francis, it's not, it doesn't matter that you understand me, it only matters that I understand you. That I, this is the really our code of love and tolerance. And I think sometimes all of Alcoholics Anonymous, all 12 steps are just, they're just tools to craft me into being a better lover of God's kids. Crafting me into being other-centered, to be God-reliant, to be driven by love. And then here's the promises, and these are remarkable. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. That mean that edge that you walk around with where you're always kind of having a little bit of conflict with life, that maybe that will stop. Maybe you won't fight anything anymore. Maybe you'll accept. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will be seldom interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. Now, it's not, this has really come true for me, but it's not that I haven't had any effort or on my part. I've had to do a lot of work to get to this point. I've had to do an inventory. I've had to make a lot of amends. I've had to do a lot of prayer, meditation. I've had to do a lot of service, sponsor guys, listen to the fifth steps. All of that is part of the package. It's just not an effort on fighting the bottle. See, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd been relapsing for a number of years, and I had fought the bottle. I gave it everything I had, and the more I fought it, the more I lost. And I didn't know that I'm fighting in the wrong arena. You guys showed me, you told me, stop fighting the bottle. We're going to show you how to fight the real problem called alcoholism, the condition of a sick self self-filled up spirit that starts to get depressed and you get full of yourself. We're going to show you how to fight in the right arena. And since I started fighting in the right arena, and my contest now is not with alcohol, it's with alcoholism, alcohol has not been a problem. But I'll tell you, just like that story I told when I started stealing from my boss, and all of a sudden, alcohol starts coming back on the horizon again. Because alcohol, I stopped living in the solution and started becoming the problem again. And this is such, this is, I think one of the great definitions of grace is it's an unmerited, undeserved gift. And this really sounds like that, that this is just, then what must have happened? I'm the guy who would beg God in prison cells, don't ever let me drink again, and drank the day I got out because I could not access his grace. There was too much of me between me and God. And if this means that something has changed within me, now I must have been able to access the grace because God is now doing for me what I can't do for myself. Something has happened to me. I didn't do it. I can't take credit for it. If I could take credit for it, I'd put it in a book and sell it and become a millionaire. I can't take credit for it. I didn't do it. All I did was avail myself of what you showed me, what it said in this book and what my sponsor and the people I got sober with told me to do. I just did what you told me to do. And little did I know that I would be, I was crafting myself to become a more adequate receiver of my own inheritance, God's grace. It had always been there. I was just blocked from it. I was like a broken receiver that can't get the signal. Signal's still coming out. I just can't receive it. And you helped me to repair the receiver. My sponsor has a great analogy. He says that we're like an old battered TV set on the back of a pickup truck on a bumpy road. You got to constantly turn in the knobs and fooling with the antenna to keep the signal in, because the minute you get it in, it goes out again. And sometimes that's what it's like to have chronic alcoholism. I am like a the back of a toilet. You flush it and it empties right out. And then I just automatically start filling up with me again. You know what I mean? I'll flush and I just start filling up with me again. So we are not, it just comes. We're not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. That sounds almost bizarre, doesn't it? It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, we're not cocky, nor are we afraid. We're not the intolerant, reformed drinker who's on the muscle about alcohol. We're not that at all. We react so long as we remain in fit spiritual condition. In page 100 of the book, it expands on this whole view, and it's kind of a dramatic thing. I go to meetings sometimes, and people just say, "Well, you just don't drink no matter what, and stay out of slippery places." And well, let's see what it says in the book. The bottom of page 100. Now, the first couple words are very, very important. This is not for new people who are 60 days sober with the benefit of step none. This is for people who have gone through the steps. You're sponsoring people. You've made your amends. Okay, you're in what the book would refer to as fit spiritual condition. It says, assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures where they show drinking scenes. Oh my God, it's a bottle of whiskey. I got to go get drunk. I can't help it. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go to their houses. We mustn't think, how do you do that? You get a lobotomy? We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. I worked around alcohol for 25 years in my sobriety. I had it in my home. Some people don't think that's a good idea. I don't know. I know a lot of people that have it in their home. I had a wine cellar for investment. It meant no more to me than the artwork in the house. I mean, it's nothing. Because I was put in the position of neutrality. And then check this out. An alcoholic who cannot meet these conditions still has an alcoholic mind. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap, and even there an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle and ruin everything. When you think about it, if you're sober 10 years and you've worked the steps and you still can't be around alcohol and it still looks like medicine and calls at you, I've got to tell you, in my view, you've missed something here. You missed something. It's either that or AA doesn't work, and I don't believe that. I've seen it work too much. So roll up your sleeves. Sometimes what you miss is step one. You did the textbook example of four. Oh my God, we should frame it, put it on the wall, and GSO. But if you never got one, and in your innermost self, where you really live, if the delusion that you somehow, someday, some way, you could still control and enjoy your drinking, if that hasn't been smashed, you're not all the way in. You have a back door. And check this next line out, this next paragraph. In our belief, any scheme for combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. It's almost like it gives it torque. We have tried these methods, these attempts to do the impossible, and they've always failed. Lack of power is my dilemma. Now, this is, now, if you're new and you haven't worked the steps yet, you need to shield yourself from temptation for a time. But if you're 10 years sober and you're still staying sober by shielding yourself from temptation, you miss something here. Either that or maybe you don't believe this will work for you. I don't know. It worked for me. There's a caution here, and this is very important. This ties in with the second delusion it talks about in chapter 3. And I've watched, you know, for twice a week now, for almost 34 years, I've gone to a Skid Row detox and watched men and women sober up again. Some of them sober many years. We had one guy 45 years, ended up there. Bill Wilson was his sponsor. We tried to make a project out of him because he had all these great stories about Bill. And he drank himself to death over the next 7-8 months, I guess, because of his ego, how much it had progressed. He was just so full. He knew what was wrong with everybody in AA, and yet he was dying of alcoholism. What a tragedy. The book says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Oh my God, it's so easy. What happens to so many of us, this happened to me, it happens to most people that I know at some point in their sobriety. And when it's happening to you, you don't know that it's happening to you. And what happens is we get comfortable here. And as I get comfortable, and I haven't thought about taking a drink for 20 years, I feel good. I got respect now. I made my amends. Everybody loves me again. It almost feels like I don't have a problem. Now, I know vaguely in an intellectual, abstract sense I still have alcoholism, but I don't really feel like it. And I think, consequently, some of us can easily be seduced by the fruits of our own program of recovery into a false sense of okayness and start to compromise the actions that put us in that place. And you don't dismantle a program of recovery that has put you in that state of freedom and oneness with where your life is clicking, where you're in the zone, you're in the realm of the spirit. You don't dismantle that instantaneously. You take it down one action, one brick at a time. Sometimes it takes you 25 years to build up this thing, and it might take you 5 to tear it down. And sometimes we tear it down one judgment at a time. Sometimes we tear it down by just compromising one little action in AA. You know, I hear guys all the time say things, you know, they're sober 30 years, and you say, come on, I'm going to go on a 12-step call. You want to go with me? And they'll say the craziest thing you've ever heard. No, I've done a lot of that. Let some of the newer people do it. You've done a lot of it, have you? Any this year? As if they're saying, I no longer have as much alcoholism as I had in the days when I needed to do that. As if they're, now if you ask them, do you still think you're alcoholic? Oh, yeah, I'm definitely an alcoholic. Well, for God's sakes, your feet just made a liar out of you. You're acting like someone who's kind of gotten over it. I mean, your life's good, isn't it? And you're not doing this anymore. What the hell happened to you? If you were to go, we had a guy in our detox years ago. He was 17 years sober and he drank again. And he was astounded that he drank because he had such a great life. And he says in detail, I don't know why I drank again. I have a big house, making a couple hundred thousand a year. I've made all my amends. My wife loves me. I have 3 kids that adore me. I have a great business. I have 2 paid for cars in the garage. I don't know why I drank again. Everything was great. And as if he thinks that all of the success was his treatment for alcoholism. Right? He got seduced. He hadn't tried to work with a newcomer in 5 years. He played golf once a month with his sponsor. That's from the chapter Into Golfing. If you saw a diabetic in a hospital just coming out of a diabetic coma, and he said, "I don't know why I went into the coma. I have a big house." I mean, that's crazy. That's nuts. But in Alcologic, that stuff makes sense to us. Makes sense. So it's easy. It's really, I've been seduced by my own life away from what I should be doing. I went into the first depression I'd gone into in a long, long time. Since the time I put the steps in my life, it was 19 years. And I sunk into a depression. And I didn't know what had happened to me. And this is exactly what had happened to me. And I didn't know it. And I don't know it because I'm still going to a meeting every day. And I'm sponsoring guys and I'm running my mouth and talking in AA. But there was a shift inside of me that was subtle and I didn't realize it. And a guy nailed me. I told him, I said, I can't shake this depression. And he said to me, he told me the truth. He said, yeah, he said, you go to meetings and you sponsor all these people and you run your mouth a lot in AA. He said, but I don't think your primary purpose is helping others. He says, I think your primary purpose is you. And it's just like, shut up. Oh, shut up, will you? And he was right. I mean, he was right. My life had become, I wanted the bragging rights of a good AA member, so I did the trappings of alcoholic. But the truth was, all I really focused on and cared about, my primary purpose was my toys and my investments and my business and my sex life and what you think of me and me. And that guy saved my ass, I'll tell you. Within a week, I had new guys in my car and I'm back to pushing myself aside and for a purpose greater than me. And here's the crazy thing. Is that I didn't know that happened to me. I didn't know what was wrong. You don't go from the guy connected, helping others, and this is really the center of your life, to the guy who's the center of your life is you. You don't make that transition overnight. It's this incremental, slow, they're boiling the frog. Slowly. You don't know it. You don't know it. I didn't know it. I think I'm a pretty bright guy. I didn't know it. Thank God for God's works through people. That's the great thing about you continue to go to meetings is that God will send you somebody. And you won't like them, but he'll send. But listen, I hope you hear this. Don't shoot the messenger. You may not like him, but he's there. God sent him. And God sends people to us. It seems to be the way of it. It says, so if we do rest on our laurels, and everybody know what a laurel is? You know about the laurel wreaths that they used, the Romans? So when you became a citizen, you got this wreath and it gave you entitlement to property and slaves and everything. You had to wear this wreath of laurels on your head. Means you've arrived. You don't have to do anything anymore. You're there. You're vested. And you wear your laurels on your head, so if you're resting on your laurels, that shows you where your head's at. we are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. It's subtle. It's sneaky. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. This is the essence of one day at a time. One day at a time is so much more than you just don't drink, even though in the beginning I hung on to that. I just don't drink today. But eventually, you really move into, this is about my spiritual condition, that every day is the day that I have to show up for this. Every day is the day that I have to push myself aside and seek God's will. Every day is the day that I need to try to forget about myself and remember you. Every day is the day where I'm showing up for service. One of the prayers I say, a simple prayer, is simply use me. Use me. I've over the years, have intermittently prayed, ask God to give me a servant's heart. Why? So I can be a noble, altruistic guy? No, because I don't want to be the other guy. Anything that will move me off of me is a good thing for me. I would rather be a servant. I'd rather be useful. Because it's better. It really is better. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. Because of what goes with me constantly is me and thoughts of me. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. In the 12 steps and 12 traditions, it talks about this same thing. It also talks about it two pages later in the book. This realignment of my will with God's, the proper use of the will. All my life, I've had this thing about me. I didn't understand it for a while. But I've had this part of me that just wants. Half the time you ask me, what do you want? I don't know, but I want something. I want more. I want. I heard a story years ago. Oh my God, that's me. This very rich family had a little boy, and they spoiled him. And the grandmother was telling the story how she was over there for Christmas, and they got this little kid, 28 just amazing toys, all wrapped in beautiful wrapping under the Christmas tree. The kid, Christmas morning, goes down there and starts tearing through these presents, and, oh, this is great, and he pushes aside and tears open, oh, this is great, pushes aside, oh, this is great, and he gets to the last one, he opens it up and pushes it aside, and he starts to cry. I didn't get what I wanted. I didn't get what I wanted. His parents love him. Oh, what do you want? We'll get whatever you want. What do you want? He goes, I don't know, but I didn't get what I wanted. Oh, my God. I thought, that's the story of my life. What do you want? I don't know, but I don't got it. And I've never been able to find the off switch for the wanter. I've looked. Sometimes I could get so drunk, it seemed I go away. I could reset. I wasn't so wanted. I didn't want so much when I get high enough. But I could never turn it off. So what do you do if you can't stop wanting? You want what someone else wants. I align my will with God's. I can't stop wanting, so I want what he wants. And I start, it's a shift. And when it says that every day, we do this stuff every day, I need this realignment back to wanting what he wants rather than wanting what I want. Much has already been said about receiving strength and inspiration and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we've begun to sense the flow of his spirit. There's a unity in that, a feeling of never being alone. To some extent, we have become God conscious. It's not theoretical anymore. It's more than faith. It's a consciousness of the presence of God in our lives. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. It's just a magical thing. But we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the right proper attitude and work at it. It'd be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. I remember I wasn't sober that long, and I really wanted to get into the meditation thing because I grew up around meditation. I did a lot. I did when I was intermittently in times when I was drinking. I grew up in a time when yoga and meditation was hip. So I'm not against meditation, but I have preconceived ideas of what it is. And by the time I come at step 11, I've developed enough self-esteem to be dangerous, which is really, what it really is ego. I become the guy who thinks he knows stuff again. So I'm ready to start doing step 11, and I start reading where these valuable suggestions about prayer and meditation, and it doesn't make sense to me. The first thing it talks about is self-examination. It says, here's the valuable, definite and valuable suggestions. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology if I kept something to myself which should have been discussed with another? Was I kind and loving towards all? What should I have done better? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? And on and on. And I just think, that ain't right. That has nothing to do with prayer and meditation. I go further on in the next paragraph. There's nothing. There's no mantras. There's no, it doesn't tell you how to sit and cross your legs. There's no breathing exercises. There's no thing. There's no little exercise to focus on something like breathe in God's grace and breathe out Bob. You know, there's nothing like that. None of it. So I do what smart, egocentric people do. We don't follow directions that don't agree with what we think they should say. So I don't do any of this. And for the next 15 to 20 years, I did everything else. And I didn't do this. I had daily readers. I read. I still, to some time to this day, occasionally I do it. The 24-hour book, day by day, one day at a time. I found the prayer of St. Francis in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. Beautiful prayer. Use that sometime to this day. Found a version I liked a little better, which is the one I use to this day. It's the one instead of make me a channel, it says make me an instrument. Some of you may have said that, seen that version of the St. Francis. Somehow I like that better. That thing I opened with this morning about I am the place where God shines through, I found that and started using that. I did a course in miracles. I went back to the church of my childhood. I said the rosary. I explored other churches. I went back and I did some things with Buddhism. I went to SGI for a while and chanted Namne Yoho Renge Kyo with the Buddhists. I got into some Zen stuff. I started reading stuff I'd read as a kid, Alan Watts and Jay Krishnamurti and Ram Dass and a lot of that stuff. Good stuff. It's all good stuff. Church was good. It's all good. It's funny. When you start working the steps, it all looks good. When you're not working the steps, it all looks horrid. But it's like your prejudices and your old ideas have melted away. And now you see the God in every... You could go to any religion and see the God there. It's different because you know why you see it in any religion? Because you brought it in the door with you. Right? Because it's in here. But I never did what they suggested in the book. And so I'm developing spiritually, but I'm intermittently plagued by some resentments and conflicts. And I still have a little bit of an emotional roller coaster from time to time. And as Dr. Silkworth says to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one, so I just kind of adjust to it, I guess. I think some of us have that ability to become like a mule in a hailstorm. We just hunker down and take it. Not really supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. I'm supposed to be a little bit wacky, right? As if being neurotic is normal, I guess. And I had a guy that I sponsor who was sober a long time, close to, I think, almost 20 years, over 15. I was about close to 20, I guess. He was probably sober 15. And he came to me and he asked me very specifically for direction. He wanted help. And he doesn't want theory. He wants me to tell him what to do in the morning for meditation. Well, the truth is, I don't know what to tell him. I've done so many different things. And the book says it's good. This isn't bad to do all that stuff. None of it's bad. It says be quick to see where religious people are right. It's good stuff. In addition to, but not in substitution for, see, I was never doing AA. There's nothing wrong with what I was doing, but I was never doing AA. And so this guy asked me, and I don't know what to tell him, so I just told him, I just give him a throwaway line, one of those throwaway lines they tell you in sponsor school, you know, when you don't know what to tell somebody, you just pray about it. I don't know. Or I didn't tell him that. I said, well, just do what it says in the book. Well, this guy doesn't have the prejudices I have. He doesn't have the opinions and the prejudgments. He just literally went to the book, and every night he started asking himself the questions, when do we retire at night? Every morning on awakening, he started considering the 24 hours ahead. He started saying the prayers, pondering his day, looking at what's on his plate, asking God to divorce his thinking from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives, praying for especially for freedom from self-will. He just did everything that was on these pages, and in no time at all, apparently he seems to be doing better than I am. And I don't like that much. I hate that. And so I just thought, well, what the hell? I should do this stuff. And I started doing it. I had to watch him do it first. And I started doing it. And it didn't make sense to me. This isn't meditation. I know what meditation is. No, I don't. I found a dictionary, one of my sponsees. It was written, a dictionary from 1913, English dictionary. And we looked up the definition of the word meditation, and I was astounded at what it said. Isn't it odd? I think I know what things mean, and I don't really. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I suspect that the definition of the word meditation may have taken a subtle shift in the 1960s with the Beatles and the Maharishi and Alan Watts and Timothy Leary and all that stuff. But regardless, in this dictionary, it talked about a contemplated focusing exercise. And it used the example, and this hit me, and I really got it. I connected the dots. It said, a general will meditate a war. And I went back to the book thinking about that picture in my mind of a general before a battle, getting up in the morning before the fight. And the night before, he's walked his army, as we do when we retire at night, constructively reviewing our day. And as he walked his army, he saw the cannons that were warped. He saw the horses that were lame. He saw the men that were wounded. And he got up the next morning and he considered his plans for the day. And we're asked to bring God in, but maybe the general brought his officers in. And he said, these horses can't go with us today. They're a liability. They're lame. Those men are wounded. They're going to be a liability in today's march. Those cannons are warped. They will hurt us today. We must pull them out of today's march. Only with me, it's self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. It's really self that will handicap me today in all its manifestations. And the book says there's a couple promises here that I think are remarkable. It says, under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. I didn't know that. I thought I was mentally ill when I got sober because of the raging insanity in my head, the conversations, the chatter that was just driving. You ever try to do meditation in early sobriety before you've cleaned oh my God, it's like, you can't, man. Oh. If you're going to try it, don't have any sharp objects around. Oh my God. It's brutal. And I didn't know. I thought my head was my enemy. I thought it was my enemy. A guy when I was new, and I was crazy, you know, I was having all these insane thoughts about people and situations and people that don't like me and how things are turning to crap in my life. And now I probably have a brain tumor and I'm going on and on and on. And this guy says to me, he says, you think that you are your mind, don't you? I said, well, yeah, it's my mind, it's my thoughts, and yeah. He said, you're not your mind. I'm not. He said, no, you're the idiot that listens to it. I thought, oh my God, I'm the listener. I thought that was me. I thought it was me. My head'd say, they don't like you, quit your job. Okay. Well, it was so. I mean, it was true. I mean, it was true. I mean, it said it to, I must, but it was me. It must be true. That's not me. That just chatters. And isn't it odd in meditation if when you get quiet in the morning, if you're like me, there's like a disconnection between the chattering. I am not the chatter. I'm the guy who listens to it. And on a good spiritual hair day, a day when I'm present and I'm right here, the chatter is like distant. I don't even hear it. It's there, I guess. You get me afraid, I start listening to it. But it's just kind of there. Contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. Contingent. And I think that, I'll say this and we'll take a break. I think that in the 12 steps and 12 traditions in step 11, it explains why the first paragraph on page 86 is actually, it's not step 10. A lot of people think, oh, that's really part of step 10. It's actually part of step 11. It says that in the 12 by 12. There's a paragraph in there that says self-examination, which is the first paragraph on 86, meditation and prayer, which is the contemplative exercises and the prayers on the bottom of 86 and all of 87. It says self-examination, meditation, and prayer, when taken separately, as if these are separate events, separate exercises, the book says can bring about much benefit and relief. That's true, but I don't want relief. I've spent my whole life as a relief seeker. How's that worked for you, Bob? I need freedom. I need intermittent freedom from the bondage of self. I need a connection with God. I don't need relief. Relief is the way to feel better, take the pressure off without having to surrender. I need freedom. And then it says, but when these things are logically, these three things, meditation, self-examination, prayer, when they're logically related and interwoven, they become an unshakable foundation for life. They're supposed to be all part of the process. And this is very much like what happens when a sailor wants to navigate the ocean. If you were to go down here to the harbor, wherever they keep the boats, and you were to buy the best boat money could buy, you just want the best. You want something really that could take you across the ocean. You want something really good. You get the best boat you can. And you went to the nautical library, and you charted the first 9 steps of navigation for the island of Bali. I'm going to go to Bali. And you do an impeccable job in that library, and you set a perfect course out for the island of Bali. You're going to leave the harbor, and every single day, the winds and the tides and the currents are going to move you off course. It's not because your boat's bad. It's not because you're a bad guy. It's not because you played with your tiller too much. It's just the way it is. It's just the nature of the beast. Every single day you're going to get moved off course. And if you're going to survive, you have to take an honest reckoning every single day of where you are. You can't fool yourself about values. You can't think you're spiritual and selfless when you're really self-centered and self-serving. You have to be honest with yourself. So why? So that you can recorrect your course back to the island of Bali. Only in our case, that we're not going to the island of Bali, we're going to carry out the decision we made in step three. The decision of to move towards self-abandonment and service. When I said to God, here I am for you to build with me and you to do with me as you will, relieve me of the bondage of self so that I can better do thy will and do all of this. Take away all these difficulties with self for one reason and one reason only, so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. And I'm entering into a decision to head my life towards the island of self-abandonment and service. And every single day, the clamorings, the fears, the attraction of things that look self-gratifying, the resentments, the judgments, everything is going to just pull me off course, and I have to recorrect and do it back to. And the problem is, if you don't do this, you can get so far out you can't get back. I've watched guys 15, 20 years sober that can't get back. They're too full of themselves. It's brutal. And what the alcoholic mind is, a shift changer. We'll start bending our view of reality to make what we think we're doing make sense to us. The next thing you know, you're just on the beach, or you're on the deck of the boat, rather, trying to sun yourself, and it's getting a little cold. But I'm going to Bali. And you start noticing the chunks of ice go by the boat with penguins on them. There's penguins. What do you say to yourself? Oh, you know, it's a new thing. They have penguins now on Bali. It's a new thing. Didn't know that. It's just new. These are Balinese penguins. And then you get so far out, you can't get back. I've watched guys bolt out of meetings because they haven't been to a meeting. They haven't talked to their sponsor. They haven't helped anybody. They haven't done step 10 and 11. And there's a little bit of 10 and 11 that occur just by showing up in a meeting if you show up in the right frame of mind. I think it's enough to keep us. That's why there is a value in going to meetings, because you can go to a meeting and maybe you're not doing that good of a job on step 10 and 11, and you're lazy, or you don't really look well, as I don't from time to time. I do when I'm in a lot of trouble. But I go through periods where I don't really look that well. But you go to a meeting, and you think you're doing fine. I'm on my way to Bali. And somebody will start sharing about their day and about how they became self-serving again and worried about themselves. And you sit there and you go, oh, man. That's me. I thought I was going to Bali. I'm in Antarctica already. I don't know. How'd that happen? I mean, you know. Right. The bottom of page 87. As we go through the day, we pause. When agitated. I know for some of you, you attack when agitated. I understand. Believe me. I came here. That was the guy that came here. It was a fire, ready, aim. Oh, you know what I mean? That was that guy. So we're trying to learn how to pause. And in the pause, we find the grace of God. I think some of us come here spring-loaded. Threaten me, will you? Spring loaded. And we pause, and in the pause, we find God. I heard Sandy Beach say one time, he was about 40 years sober when he said it. He said, it seemed to me like I got a second for every year I was sober in the pause before I reacted. He said, you can change your whole world in 40 seconds. You can change your whole world in 40 seconds. You can change your whole world in 5 if you pause. Don't react. We pause when agitated or doubtful. We ask for the right thought or action. and we find God's grace. And I love this line. This is a great line. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. No, why don't we have to do this constantly? Oh, because I'm constantly trying to run the show. That's right, I forgot. Okay, all right. All right, I get it. There's a movie out, and I'm not I don't promote anything here except Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you a movie I saw that I liked and it affected me because it lined up with some of the stuff I found in AA. It was a movie called What the Bleep Do We Know? And if you've never seen this movie, it's a remarkable movie. It's all these world-renowned, brilliant physicists talking about God and the universe. And it's remarkable. And they're talking about things like quantum mechanics, about how we interact mysteriously with the universe, that the thing you're observing is affected by the observer. There's an interaction here that transcends material contact. It was an amazing movie. And What the Bleep Do We Know? And there's a part in there where there was this Japanese scientist, Dr. Emoto. And Dr. Emoto, I ordered a whole DVD of him. It's a little hard to watch because it's through an interpreter. But Dr. Emoto did some amazing, amazing experiments. He went, there's this one glacier in Japan that is revered, is very ancient and very spiritual. And he took bottles, liters of water from the glacier. And in each liter, he would label it with a Buddhist prayer of love. And then he would say these loving incantations over the water and praise the water. And then he put the water in a nitrogen bath that flash froze the water and crystallized it instantaneously into crystals. And he put those crystals under an electron microscope. And the crystals that had been prayed about with love were spectacular. They were amazing. They were beautiful. They just looked like you wanted to frame and put them on your wall. They were the most amazing, ethereal things you've ever seen. There was a beauty and a spirit in them. It was wonderful. And then he took some water took this 1 liter of water and he cursed it and he said, "I hate you. I hate you." And he screamed and yelled at it and he flash froze it and he put the crystals and they looked horrid. They looked something out of a Tim Burton movie. I mean, it was freaky stuff. And then he said something that affected me. He said, "If I am almost 90% water and my thoughts can do that to water, what do they do to my life? What do they do to me?" And so the book says that God gave his brains to use. In this disconnecting ourselves from ourselves, now my mind is not my enemy anymore. It is a tool. The mind is a tremendous tool. I remember my sponsor's phone number, good stuff like that. That's important. You could lose your cell. If you don't remember your sponsor's phone number and you have to have your cell phone to call him, remember your sponsor's phone number. It may save your life one day. I can remember commitments. I can remember my daughter's birthday. I can remember the birthdays of some of the people I sponsor. I can remember what time my home group starts and the address, and I can tell people where it is. I can remember things I've learned out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that couple with my experience that I can remember or become useful. The mind is an amazing tool. It's just a horrid master. And I'm moving my life to a different management system. And that's the essence of it. Let's take a break.